Bill thought of it, not so differently, as a broken heart. Mr. Tao was a man in his 50s, said Bill. He told me through an interpreter that he had a bad back, but after I listened for a while, I realized that he'd really come in because of depression. It turned out he was an agoraphobe. He was afraid to leave his house because he thought if he walked more than a couple of blocks, he'd get lost and never find his way home again. What a metaphor! He'd seen his entire immediate family die in Laos. He'd seen his country collapse, and he never was going to find his way home again. All I could do was prescribe antidepressants. Mr. Tao turned out to be the first of a long procession of depressed Hmong patients whom Bill was to treat over the next 3 years. Bill cut to the nub of the matter when he described the man's profound loss of home. For the Hmong in America, where not only the social mores, but also the sound of every bird song, the shape of every tree and flower, the smell of the air, and the very texture of the earth are unfamiliar, the ache of homesickness can be incapacitating. In Lament Upon Leaving Our Country, a Hmong poet named Dua Her wrote, "We remember the bird songs at sunrise. We remember the grasshoppers jumping at dawn. We remember the sound of heavy raindrops on leaves. We remember the song of the male gibbon. We remember the fruit trees, the pineapple, banana, and papaya. We can still hear the owls cry to each other like we cry." John Fink of the Rhode Island Resettlement Office once took a party of Hmong from Providence to visit Plymouth Plantation, a reconstructed pilgrim village with thatched houses and free-running chickens. When it came time to leave, one of the older men in the group asked Fink, "Can we move here and make this our home?" Dang Moore, the energetic grocer-cum-interpreter-cum-pig farmer, mentioned once that after 13 years in the United States, he dreamed of Laos every night and had never once dreamed of America. "I talked to more than 100 Hmong about this," he said. "I talked to General Vang Pao. Same thing for everyone." In a heroic act of denial, only 10% of the Hmong refugees polled in a Minnesota survey said that they were certain they would spend the rest of their lives in the United States. The rest were either certain or hopeful that they would die in Laos. John Zhang, a Hmong leader in Merced, told me, "All the older people, they say, we want to go back. We born over there. We come here. Very nice country, but we don't speak the language. We cannot drive. We just stay home isolated. Over there, we can have a little piece of farm. Raise chicken, pig, and cow. Don't forget to wake up early. Harvest on time. Make enough this year to another coming year. That's it. Then we feeling like peaceful. Here, we do right and they say wrong. Then we do wrong and they say right. Which way we go? We want to go home." The home to which the older Hmong dream of returning, which they call Pelutekyar, our fields and our lands, is pre-war Laos. Their memories of wartime Laos are almost unrelievedly traumatic, a bereavement overload that critically magnifies all their other stresses. Richard Mollica, a psychiatrist who helped found the Indo-Chinese Psychiatry Clinic in Boston, found that during the war and its aftermath, Hmong refugees had experienced an average of 15 major trauma events, such as witnessing killings and torture. Mollica has observed of his patients, "Their psychological reality is both full and empty. They are full of the past. They are empty of new ideas and life experiences. Full of both past trauma and past longing, the Hmong have found it especially hard to deal with present threats to their old identities. I once went to a conference on Southeast Asian mental health at which a psychologist named Evelyn Lee, who was born in Macau, invited 6 members of the audience to come to the front of the auditorium for a role-playing exercise. She cast them as a grandfather, a father, a mother, an 18-year-old son, a 16-year-old daughter, and a 12-year-old daughter. Okay, she told them. Line up according to your status in your old country. Ranking themselves by traditional notions of age and gender, they queued up in the order I've just mentioned, with the grandfather standing proudly at the head of the line. Now they come to America, said Dr. Lee. Grandfather has no job. Father can only chop vegetables. Mother didn't work in the old country, but here she gets a job in a garment factory. Oldest daughter works there too. Son drops out of high school because he can't learn English. Youngest daughter learns the best English in the family and ends up at UC Berkeley. Now you line up again. As the family reshuffled, I realized that its power structure had turned completely upside down, with the youngest girl now occupying the head of the line and the grandfather standing forlornly at the tail. Dr. Lee's exercise was an eloquent demonstration of what sociologists call role loss. Of all the stresses in the Hmong community, role loss, the constellation of apparent incompetencies that convinced Leah's mother she was stupid, may be the most corrosive to the ego. Every Hmong can tell stories about colonels who became janitors, military communications specialists who became chicken processors, flight crewmen who found no work at all. Deng Muo's cousin, Muo Ki, a former judge, worked first in a box factory and then on the night shift in a machine shop. When you have no country, no land, no house, no power, everyone is the same, he said with a shrug. Major Wang Sang-Kang, a former battalion commander who served as a leader for 10,000 Hmong in his refugee camp, took 5 years to find a job as a part-time church liaison. Even then, he depended on his wife's wages from a jewelry factory to pay the rent and on his children to translate for him. Of himself and his fellow leaders, he said, "We have become children in this country." And in this country, the real children have assumed some of the power that used to belong to their elders. The status conferred by speaking English and understanding American conventions is a phenomenon familiar to most immigrant groups, but the Hmong, whose identity has always hinged on tradition, have taken it particularly hard. Animals are responsible to their masters and children to their parents, advised a Hmong proverb that survived unquestioned for countless generations. In pre-war Laos, where families worked in the fields all day and shared a single room at night, it was not uncommon for children and parents to be together around the clock. Remoteness and altitude insulated their villages from the majority culture. Hmong children here spend 6 hours in school and often several more at large in their communities, soaking up America. My sisters don't feel they're Hmong at all, my interpreter Mei Ying Zhang once told me. One of them has spiked hair. The youngest one speaks mostly English. I don't see the respect I gave elders at that age. Leah's sister Mei said, I know how to do pan tao, but I hate sewing. My mom says, why aren't you doing pan tao? I say, Mom, this is America. Although Americanization may bring certain benefits, more job opportunities, more money, less cultural dislocation, Hmong parents are likely to view any earmarks of assimilation as an insult and a threat. In our families, the kids eat hamburger and bread, said Deng Muo sadly, whereas the parents prefer hot soup with vegetables, rice, and meat like tripes or liver or kidney that the young ones don't want. The old ones may have no driver's licenses and they ask the young ones to take them someplace. Sometimes the kids say, I'm too busy. That is a serious situation when the kid will not obey us. The old ones are really upset. Rebellious young Hmong sometimes go beyond refusing to chauffeur their parents and tangle with drugs or violence. In 1994, Su Yang, a 19-year-old high school dropout from Banning, California, robbed and murdered a German tourist. His father, a veteran of the war in Laos, told a reporter, "We have lost all control. Our children do not respect us. One of the hardest things for me is when I tell my children things and they say, 'I already know that.' When my wife and I try to tell my son about Hmong culture, he tells me people here are different, and he will not listen to me." Suki Waller, Merced's maverick psychologist, once recalled a Hmong community meeting she had attended. An old man of 70 or 80 stood up in the front row, she said, and he asked one of the most poignant questions I have ever heard. "Why, when what we did worked so well for 200 years, is everything breaking down?" When Suki told me this, I understood why the man had asked the question, but I thought he was wrong. Much has broken down, but not everything. Jacques Lemoyne's analysis of the post-war hegira, that the Hmong came to the West to save not only their lives but their ethnicity, has been at least partially confirmed in the United States. I can think of no other group of immigrants whose culture and its most essential aspects has been so little eroded by assimilation. Virtually all Hmong still marry other Hmong, marry young, obey the taboo against marrying within their own clans, pay bride prices, and have large families. Clan and lineage structures are intact, as is the ethic of group solidarity and mutual assistance. On most weekends in Merced, it is possible to hear a death drum beating at a Hmong funeral or a Tsineng's gong and rattle sounding at a healing ceremony. Babies wear strings on their wrists to protect their souls from abduction by Das. People divine their fortunes by interpreting their dreams. If you dream of opium, you will have bad luck. If you dream you are covered with excrement, you will have good luck. If you dream you have a snake on your lap, you will become pregnant. Animal sacrifices are common, even among Christian converts. A fact I first learned when Mei Ying Zhong told me that she would be unavailable to interpret one weekend because her family was sacrificing a cow to safeguard her niece during an upcoming open-heart operation. When I said, "I didn't know your family was so religious," she replied, "Oh yes, we're Mormon." Even more crucially, the essential Hmong temperament, independent, insular, anti-authoritarian, suspicious, stubborn, proud, choleric, energetic, vehement, loquacious, humorous, hospitable, generous, has so far been ineradicable. Indeed, as George M. Scott Jr. has observed, the Hmong have responded to the hardships of life in the United States by becoming more Hmong rather than less so. Summing up his impressions of the Hmong in 1924, François-Marie Savina, the French missionary, attributed their ethnic durability to six factors: religion, love of liberty, traditional customs, refusal to marry outside their race, life in cold, dry, mountainous areas, and the toughening effects of war. Even though their experience here has been less suffused with despair and loss, the 180,000 Hmong who live in the United States are doing passably or better on the first four counts. I was able to see the whole cycle of adjustment to American life start all over again during one of my visits to Merced. When I arrived at the Lees' apartment, I was surprised to find it crammed with people I'd never met before. These turned out to be a cousin of Nakao's named Zhuo Chai Li, his wife Yang Lor, and their nine children, who ranged in age from 8 months to 25 years. They had arrived from Thailand 2 weeks earlier, carrying one piece of luggage for all 11 of them. In it were packed some clothes, a bag of rice, and because Zhuo is a Tsineng's assistant, a set of rattles, a drum, and a pair of divinatory water buffalo horns. The cousins were staying with Four and Nakao until they found a place of their own. The two families had not seen each other in more than a decade, and there was a festive atmosphere in the little apartment, with small children dashing around in their new American sneakers and the four barefooted adults frequently throwing back their heads and laughing. Zhuo said to me, via Mei Ying's translation, "Even though there are a lot of us, you can spend the night here too." Mei Ying explained to me later that Zhuo didn't really expect me to lie down on the floor with 20 of his relatives. It was simply his way, even though he was in a strange country where he owned almost nothing, of extending a face-saving bit of Hmong hospitality. I asked Zhuo what he thought of America. "It is really nice, but it is different," he said. "It is very flat. You cannot tell one place from another. There are many things I have not seen before. Like that," a light switch. "And that," a telephone. "And that," an air conditioner. "Yesterday, our relatives took us somewhere in a car, and I saw a lady, and I thought she was real, but she was fake." This turned out to have been a mannequin at the Merced Mall. "I couldn't stop laughing all the way home," he said. And remembering how funny his mistake had been, he started to laugh again. Then I asked Zhuo what he hoped for his family's future here. "I will work if I can," he said, "but I think I probably cannot. As old as I am, I think I will not be able to learn one word of English. If my children put a heart to it, they will be able to learn English and get really smart. But as for myself, I have no hope." Chapter 15. Gold and Dross. When I met Nakao's cousin and his family at the Lees' apartment, there was, of course, one child who was not playing games with her newfound cousins or sitting on the doorstep and watching the cars drive down East 12th Street in the spring twilight, the hour the Lees' still called pig-feeding time. Leah was on her mother's back, swaddled in a bright pink nia, an apron-shaped baby carrier that Fo had embroidered with black, yellow, and green cross-stitching and ornamented with 18 fuzzy pink pom-poms. It was perhaps the largest nia in Hmong history, since Leah was more than 3 feet tall and weighed 36 pounds. Fo preferred it to the pediatric wheelchair provided by the Merced County Health Department that sat in the corner of the living room. A shawl was wrapped around them both, and from a distance, because Leah's body lay stiff and motionless against her mother's, they looked like a single person. Leah was almost 7. For more than 2 years, her doctors had been waiting for her to die, and her parents had been confounding them in their ability to keep her alive. Although Leah was not dead, she was quadriplegic, spastic, incontinent, and incapable of purposeful movement. Her condition was termed a persistent vegetative state. Most of the times her arms were drawn up tightly against her chest and her fists were clenched, a sign of cerebral motor damage. Sometimes her legs trembled. Sometimes her head nodded, not in jerks, but slowly, as if she were asserting to a question underwater. Sometimes she moaned or whimpered. She continued to breathe, swallow, sleep, wake, sneeze, snore, grunt, and cry, because those functions were governed by her unimpaired brainstem. But she had no self-aware mental activity, a function governed by the forebrain. Her most conspicuously aberrant feature was her eyes, which, although clear, sometimes stared blankly, and sometimes darted to one side as if she were frightened. Looking at her, I could not help feeling that something was missing beyond the neurotransmittive capabilities of her cerebral cortex, and that her parents' name for it, her pli, or soul, was as good a term as any. I once said to Terry Hutchison, Leah's neurologist at Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno, But she must have some consciousness. She can cry, and when her mother picks her up and rocks her, she stops. Terry Hutchison replied, Well, you take a Venus flytrap. Does it decide to snap at a fly that is walking on its pod, or does it just do it? I think it just does it. Leah is like a flytrap. It's all reflex. Nevertheless, I do believe, even though there is no way you can ask people like that how they feel, that it is at least theoretically possible for her to have no thoughts, no memories, no conscious life, and yet respond to her mother's touch. I asked Leah's parents what they thought their daughter could sense. Nikau said, When we hold her, she knows it and is smiling. Four said, Sometimes when I call her, it seems that she does recognize me, but I don't really know because it seems that Leah cannot see me. My baby hasn't done anything bad. She is a good girl, but because she is hurt like this, it is just as if she is dead. Every day now, she cannot see me. On December 9, 1986, Leah had returned home from the MCMC with a fever of 104 degrees, an irregular breathing pattern, an inability to cough up or swallow her own secretions, and a prognosis of imminent death. Within days, her temperature was normal, her breathing was regular, her swallowing and gag reflexes were back. Scratching their heads, her doctors attributed these improvements to reduced swelling in the medulla and the hypothalamus. Her parents attributed them to the herbal infusion with which they had bathed their daughter when she first came home, and for many days thereafter. They'd put a shower curtain on the living room floor and lay Leah on it, recalled Janine Hilt. Four would drench her in this tea remedy that she had cooked up, just sponging it all over her body and her hair and her head. It was really quite a soothing thing, a loving thing. During Leah's first days at home, Janine had visited the Lees every day. It was because of her that Four and Nikau left the hated nasogastric tube, which they had been directed to use for the remainder of Leah's life, in place for an entire week. Under Janine's guidance, they poured 2 ounces of infant formula down the tube every 2 hours, checking its placement by injecting air through a syringe and listening for the bubbles through a stethoscope. It was really slow, recalled Nikau, and I didn't really know how to use it. That tube had 2 plastic things, and if the food gets stuck in there, then you can't feed anymore. Finally, they yanked it out of Leah's nose and started squeezing formula into her mouth with a baby bottle. This worked perfectly, even though the doctors had predicted that without the tube, Leah would choke to death. The only problem was that because the prescribed tube was no longer being used, Medi-Cal refused to pay for the formula. So Neil and Peggy started giving the family entire cases of Similac with iron, intended to be dispensed as free samples to new mothers. Medi-Cal was willing to pay for a wheelchair and a suction machine, but it drew the line at a pediatric hospital bed. This bed, which the Lees had never requested, became the focal point toward which all of Janine's grief and rage about Leah's condition converged. When Medi-Cal said they wouldn't pay for it, it just pissed me off to the max, she said. Some all-powerful doctor in the regional barrel said that the monks sleep on the floor anyway, so they didn't need it. He was a real racist, and I told him so. I just went crazy, berserk, and I started calling 1,000,001 places. Finally, I got a medical supply company I found in the Yellow Pages to provide a brand new bed and deliver it to the Lees' home completely free. Janine never found out that Leah did not sleep in this bed, which stood for years next to her parents' double bed, taking up space in their tiny bedroom. Leah always sleeps with us, Four told me. She is the only child who sleeps in our bed. I hold her during the night and we pat her feet all night long because we love her so much. If you don't pat Leah on her foot or her knee, she cries a lot. The first time Leah returned to the clinic for a checkup, Neil was on duty. During her last stay at MCMC, he had so successfully distanced himself from her case that although he had seen Leah, He had not seen Fo and Nikau since their daughter's return from Fresno. Years later, when he looked through Leah's medical chart, he paused for a long time when he came to the clinic note from that visit. I wondered what he found so emotionally compelling about, "Today, Leah is afebrile with a temperature of 98.3, auxiliary, weight 42 pounds, and hemoglobin is 11. He cleared his throat. "That first visit was a very significant visit for me," he said. "It was very emotional. I remember Janine Hilt was in the room too, also an interpreter. I remember talking to the mother and saying it was very hard for me to see Leah the way she was, to actually be in the same room with her, and that what had happened was something I had always feared, and that I was very sorry. And what absolutely blew me away is that I was afraid they were going to blame me for what happened. But the mother showed me compassion. She understood. Somehow, she got the... Neil was scrabbling uncomfortably for words, but he was determined to forge ahead. "Well, I think part of it was that I was crying. What she did was, she thanked me, and she hugged me, and I hugged her." He cleared his throat again. "So anyway, when I asked Fua about that encounter, all she said was, 'Leah's doctor really hurt for her.'" Nikau scowled and remained silent. He had never stopped being angry at MCMC and everyone who worked there. Fua, temperamentally more accommodating than her husband, had managed to divert all her blame to the doctors in Fresno who had given Leah too much medicine, thereby partially exonerating Neil and Peggy. In her eyes, the husband and wife doctors were guilty not of the mortal sin of destroying her daughter, but of the lesser sin, a sin of omission, of going on vacation and leaving Leah in the wrong hands. As the months passed, Leah became, in some cockeyed sense, a radiantly vital child. Although every page of her chart contained the notation, "Hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, static, irreparable brain damage," one clinic report also noted, "Problem, seizure disorder, ondepakine, resolved. Problem, obesity, resolved." In other words, Leah's brain damage had cured her epilepsy, and over time, as she grew taller, or rather longer, since she never stood again, her obligatory soft food diet cured her obesity. "She was real healthy," said Peggy with a jaunty sarcasm. "She was the healthiest she'd ever been. She was just perfect, a perfect vegetable." Suddenly, Leah was, as Bill Selvidge once told me dryly, just the sort of patient nurses like. She had metamorphosed from a hyperactive child with a frightening seizure disorder and inaccessible veins into an inert, uncomplaining body who would probably never need another IV. Simultaneously, in the eyes of the family practice staff, her parents were miraculously transformed from child abusers to model caregivers. Teresa Callahan, a resident who had seen Leah during both phases, told me her mom and dad must have taken wonderful care of her because she grew so much. Most kids that are that severely gorked sort of shrivel up and turn into a bag of bones. I've seen 17-year-olds who were the size of 4-year-olds. Neil said, "Whenever they brought her into the clinic in that baby carrier, Leah was always well-groomed, well-dressed, and immaculate. Just immaculate. It was very impressive." Peggy added, "They did a better job than most white families. Most white families would institutionalize her in a second." Fo and Nikau could never figure out why the clinic staff treated them so much better than the hospital staff ever had. From their point of view, their daughter had changed utterly, but their behavior as parents had not changed in the slightest. The only explanation Nakao could come up with was, Leah doesn't go to the bathroom very often, so she is clean and that is why they like her. When I heard him ascribe Leah's newfound popularity to her constipation, I was reminded of the comment he had once made when I told him I would like to visit Laos someday. Having taken due note of America's obsession with technology and hygiene, he said, You wouldn't like it. There are no cars. But you would think Chiang Mai in Thailand is very nice. When I asked why, he said, Because it has a lot of garbage collectors. Now that the anticonvulsants were no longer prescribed and compliance was no longer an issue, Merced's doctors, nurses, CPS workers, public health workers, and juvenile court officers, the clamorous army of authority figures who had been telling the Lees for 4 years that they were not taking good care of their daughter, suddenly fell silent. On March 5th, 1987, the Lees' probationary status as Leah's guardians, which had been in effect since their daughter was released from foster care, was lifted. In the matter of Leah Lee, a dependent child of the juvenile court, the Superior Court of California for the County of Merced declared, Whereas it now appears to the satisfaction of the court that it is for the best interests of the above-named minor that juvenile court jurisdiction be terminated. It is hereby ordered that the court heretofore made by this court, adjudging Leah Lee to be a dependent child of the juvenile court be, and the same is hereby vacated and set aside, and the said person is hereby released from the operation thereof. Pho and Nakao never trusted this document, which of course they could not read, and which in any case would be almost impossible to render in Hmong. They continued to fear that their daughter might once again be made government property. For several years, Pho, who never let herself forget that she had been visiting relatives on the day Leah had been removed to foster care, stayed with her 24 hours a day to make sure she was not snatched by the police. If we allow, said Nakao, they probably would take her away again, but we just love Leah too much, and we don't want anybody to take her. My wife watches Leah every day so they cannot take her. My wife would not let them. The anthropologist George M. Scott Jr. has written that in Laos, children were generally deeply adored. Even those with physical or mental deformities were showered with affection, indeed, with even greater affection than normal children, which resulted in part from the belief that, as with miscarriages and stillbirths, the deformity was the consequence of past transgressions on the part of the parents and thus must be borne with equanimity and treated with kindness as a means of expiation. Pho and Nakao were fairly sure, but not certain, that transgressions on part of American doctors, not their own part, were responsible for Leah's condition. But no expiatory motivation was needed. They showered Leah with affection because they could not imagine doing otherwise. They had always thought of her as an anointed one, a princess. Now, constantly attended by her parents and siblings, she had assumed a position in the family that was, if anything, even more regal. She was a central stillness around which the life of the family condensed. If she sat in her wheelchair, someone was always at her elbow. If she was strapped into a nia, her bearer, whether it was her mother, her father, or one of her older sisters, did a constant little swaying dance to soothe her. More photographs of her hung on the walls than any of her 8 siblings. For years, the schedule Janine had once written for her, wake up, meds, leave for school, playtime, continued to hang there too, even though she no longer took medicines, went to school, or played. Whether she still woke up in the morning was a question of semantics. Leah Lee was the only Lee child who had birthday parties, Every July 19, the sidewalk outside the East 12th Street apartment overflowed with relatives and Hmong children. Janine Hilt brought frisbees, beach balls, and water pistols. Pho served Hmong egg rolls stuffed with minced pork and onion, steamed bananas with rice, chickens that had been sacrificed that morning, and their skulls and tongues examined for divinatory signs before they were stewed, and Doritos. There was always an American birthday cake. Janine lit the candles and cut the first piece. The guest of honor, of course, could not blow out her candles or eat her cake. She sat in her wheelchair, immobile and impassive, while the children who had learned a standard repertoire of American songs in school sang happy birthday. Leah was still a beautiful child. She was nothing like the patients in vegetative states, whom I had seen in hospitals. Pasty-skinned carcasses with slack mouths, hair like straw, bodies that smelled of urine even after they were bathed. Leah's black hair was still shiny, her skin was soft and fine, her lips were still pink and shaped like a cupid's bow. She smelled delicious. It therefore never seemed strange to me that her family treated her as one would an especially winsome baby. A diapered, bottle-fed, fussing baby who just happened to be 3 feet tall. Pho cuddled her, stroked her, rocked her, bounced her, sang to her, nuzzled her neck, inhaled her hair, played with her fingers, and made raspberry sounds against her belly. There were also times when Leah seemed more like a pet. A golden retriever, perhaps, with strokable fur and a tractable disposition. Her younger sister Pang liked to give her bear hugs, tuck her ears, and then, joined by Mai and True, lie on top of her in a heap. Three squirming, giggling children and one silent one. In Laos, Pho had bathed her children on the dirt floor, using a small bowl to pour the stream water that she had warmed on the fire. Now she bathed Leah in the porcelain tub every day, on hot days twice. "I usually get in with her," she said, "because by the time I'm done, I'm all wet anyway." After the bath, she bent and extended Leah's arms and legs as a child would flex the limbs of a Barbie doll in a series of range-of-motion exercises taught her by the health department that were intended to forestall permanent contractures. She fed Leah by spoon or from a 6-ounce bottle with a broad, flat, easy-to-suckle nipple designed for babies with cleft palates. A residence's note from the MCMC clinic stated that parents feed her formula plus rice cereal. In fact, Leah also ate pork and chicken that her mother had ground to a fine consistency with the hand-carved mortar and pestle that she had brought from Laos. Sometimes, Pho simply pre-chewed the chicken like a mother bird and stuffed it into Leah's mouth. Every day, Pho boiled quantities of a spinach-like vegetable called zhao, which she grew specially for Leah in the parking lot, and fed her the broth. Leah usually straddled Pho's lap, her long legs sticking out on either side, while Pho, after putting her lips to the food to make sure it wasn't too hot, coaxed tiny bites into her mouth. She always wiped Leah's drool with her hand rather than with a napkin or a towel. "It takes a long time to eat," she told me once as she fed Leah rice. "You have to open Leah's mouth to look inside, because if there is already rice in there and you put some more in, she might vomit it back out. You have to hold your hand in the back of her neck all the time or she can't swallow." Then she laughed and kissed Leah's ricey mouth. Sometimes, I thought, this is not so terrible. Leah lived at home, not in a chronic care facility. She was a love object, not a pariah. The Hmong community accepted her without reservation. Her mother was not suicidal, as she had been after Leah was placed in foster care. It was true that Pho and Nakao sometimes slighted her siblings, especially Pang, who had never been allowed to assume her rightful place as the youngest and most coddled member of the family. When Pang was barely out of toddlerhood, she zoomed in and out of the apartment unsupervised, playing with plastic bags and, on occasion, with a large butcher knife. Still, none of the Lees, even the teenagers, ever seemed embarrassed by Leah, as most of the American children I knew might be. Because Leah's continual epileptic crises was over, May, as the eldest daughter living at home, had been largely relieved of the pressures of serving as her parents' medical interpreter. "I had to go with my parents to the hospital to translate," she wrote in her eighth-grade autobiography, speaking of the year after Leah's return from foster care. "I never had my way out, 'cause most of my cousin who my parent needed the most are always busy doing this and that. I was like their translator everywhere they go." Carrying her sister in a nye, feeding her formula, and doing the family's shopping at the Save Mart on J Street were far lighter responsibilities. But whenever I began to be lulled by this relatively rosy picture, I was drawn up short by an explosion of rage from Nakao. "My child is lost because of those doctors," or more frequently, by a sudden seepage of grief from Fu. One minute Fu would be laughing and the next she would be in tears. She would go for weeks without a word of complaint and then exclaim, "Leah is so heavy, she is so hard to carry. Other people see nice places, but I never can." She went for 2 years without sewing any pandao except Leah's giant nia. "Leah is too sick," she said, "and I am too sad. I am so busy with Leah that I don't know anything except being alive." Once I saw her rocking back and forth on her haunches, keening. When I asked her what was the matter, she just said, "I love Leah too much." A half-finished bottle of Depakine syrup, which was no longer prescribed for Leah and which Neil and Peggy assumed had been thrown out long ago, continued to sit on a kitchen shelf for years. It was not there to be used. It was there because the American doctors had once considered it priceless, and discarding it would have been like tossing out a pile of foreign coins that were no longer negotiable, but had not altogether shed their aura of value. Fu and Nakao treated Leah with what they called Hmong medicines. "We can't give her any kind of medicine from the hospital," Nakao explained, "because if we do, she gets really tense and her body twists into some kind of tight knot." They fed her teas made from the powdered roots imported from Thailand, which they bought at a Hmong-owned market, and from herbs they grew for her in the parking lot. A stainless steel mixing bowl filled with sacred water and covered with two pieces of fringed paper hung by a length of twine from the ceiling of their bedroom. A Tsineng had placed it there as a lure for Leah's errant soul. About twice a year, or more often if they could afford it, a Tsineng came to their apartment to perform a pig sacrifice. For several weeks afterwards, Leah wore soul-binding strings around her wrists. Because the detested anticonvulsants were no longer prescribed, and because Fu's feelings for Leah's doctors had become almost fond since the day she and Neil had hugged, they continued to carry Leah about once a year to the MCMC clinic, though not to the hospital next door. Leah's problems, constipation, conjunctivitis, pharyngitis, could now be dealt with on an outpatient basis. When Leah missed an appointment, the clinic's computer, fixed in its imperturbable bureaucratic groove, sent her this reminder. "Dear Leah Lee, on 2/29/88, you had an appointment with Dr. Philp which you did not keep. Your physician feels that you should be seen. Please call the Merced Family Practice Center at 385-7060 so that we can schedule another appointment for you." Leah never called. The Lees' most frequent encounters with Merced's medical establishment were now the checkups, first weekly, then monthly, then two or three times a year, performed by a public health nurse who, like a Tsineng, made house calls. The nurse was named Martin Kilgore. Martin was a large, kind, eccentric man who was undoubtedly the only employee of the Merced County Health Department with an all-over tan from vacationing at a nudist camp. His politics were liberal. His IQ, as he once confided with a self-deprecating grin, was 150, and his conversation was peppered with references to classical literature. He referred to Leah's daemon and her Moira as often as to her hypoxic isochemic encephalopathy. Once, he compared the relationship between the Lees and their medical providers to the myth of Sisyphus, the Corinthian king who attempted to cheat death by placing him in fetters. I mentioned Martin's analogy to Neo. He had never heard of Sisyphus, but when I described how the old reprobate had been condemned to roll a boulder up a hill over and over again, only to have it roll back down just before he reached the summit, Neil said, "That's perfect!" Later, it occurred to me that although Neil instinctively identified with Sisyphus, the Lees would undoubtedly have maintained that they were the ones who had done the boulder pushing. Martin had first met Leah and her family in the spring of 1985, before she was placed in foster care. He had been sent to the Lee home to determine whether her parents were giving her the proper amounts of Tegretol and phenobarbital. They weren't. Not knowing what he was in for, he wrote a note to MCMC that concluded, "Thank you for this interesting referral." The sheaf of impeccably typed, formally phrased letters that he had dispatched to Neil and Peggy documented, year by year, his own gallant efforts to roll the boulder up the hill and the boulder's repeated descents. His main concern was now Leah's constipation, part of a generalized gastrointestinal slowdown caused by her neurological impairment. In February of 1988, when Leah's vegetative state had lasted for about a year, he informed Peggy that Leah continues to have impacted stools on a weekly basis. His next sentence was a model of repertorial tact. The mother states that she is using Metamucil assiduously, but their bottle is full and covered with dust. Martin once invited me to accompany him to one of his home visits. I was curious to see how he and the Lees dealt with each other, since, unlike most of Merced's medical community, Martin was a vocal Hmong partisan. He had a clearer grasp of the Hmong role in the war in Laos than anyone else I met in Merced, and had written dozens of letters to local newspapers castigating the readers for their intolerance. One reader had been so angry he had threatened to blow Martin away with a shotgun, causing Martin, for reasons more alphabetical than literary, to change his listing in the Merced telephone directory to Joyce Kilmer. Martin didn't dislike the Lees, or at least preferred them to some of his Caucasian clients whose parenting skills he described as inferior to those of chimpanzees. He had so strongly disagreed with Neil's decision to place Leah with a foster family that, jettisoning all professional objectivity, he had once told Nakao, "Mr. Lee, in America, we get lawyers when people do things like that." I figured that if anyone could communicate with the Lees, it would be Martin. When Martin and his interpreter Kua Her arrived at the Lees' apartment, Fu was kneeling on the floor, feeding Leah a bottle of water, and Nakao was sitting next to her with Pang on his lap. "Hello, Mr. Lee," Martin boomed. Nakao focused on the wall-to-wall carpet and said nothing. Martin lowered himself to the floor. "Now, Mr. Lee," he said, "what is your daughter eating? Is it mostly liquid?" I realized, with surprise, that the Lees had never told him about the chicken and pork Fua mashed with her mortar and pestle. Kua Her, a small, conscientious, self-effacing man, translated Martin's questions in a scarcely audible voice as he translated, or attempted to translate, all of Martin's subsequent questions from English to Hmong, and the Lees' answers from Hmong to English. Fua mumbled something. She says it is very soft food, said Kuo.
Well, said Martin, empirically, Li is not gaining or losing weight. I can tell that whatever they are doing nutritionally is definitely all right.
Without explaining what he was doing, he started to tickle Leah's feet. He noted her Babinski reflex, an extension of the big toe that signifies damage to the central nervous system. He then put his stethoscope against her abdomen. Leah started to howl like a wolf. Fu put her face next to Leah's and crooned. I am listening for bowel sounds, said Martin. I hardly hear any bowel sounds, so I am going to listen to her chest. Her lungs are good. Now, the last time I was here, I talked about why it would be nice if we could take her temperature every day, just so we could find out if there is a problem coming up. Do they remember that? Kuo said. She said yes, they do that every day.
Martin looked pleased.
And what is her usual temperature? She says 30 or 40. That stopped Martin momentarily, but he pressed on. Ah, well, let's move to the pulse then. He burrowed his finger between the soul-binding strings on Leah's wrist. Now I'm counting her pulse. She has a pulse of 100. It is good if the mama can take her pulse every day. She says they don't know how to tell the pulse, says Kuo. Well, you just put your finger here and take your watch and count for a minute. Fu didn't own a watch, nor did she know what a minute was. At this point, Peng, who was 3 at the time, ran over to Leah and started banging her on the chest.
Don't do that. There's a good boy, said Martin, addressing the little girl in English, of which she did not speak a word.
Kuo, please tell them they have to watch these other little children. Leah is not a doll. He coughed.
Now, let us proceed to elimination. Does Leah have a bowel movement by herself, or do they have to give her a pill first?
He was referring to the Dulcolax tablets that the Lees sometimes used. Like fast-acting antibiotics, laxatives were acceptable to many Hmong because they worked quickly, unambiguously, and without apparent side effects. She says they used the pill for it to come out.
Well, it is really better not to use those pills on a regular basis.
It would be better to give her fiber in the form of Metamucil, because if you keep using the medicine, then Leah will lose the ability to move her bowels by herself, and she will always have to take the medicine, and that is a bad thing. When Kuo translated this, Fu and Nakao stared at him. For 4 years, they had been told to give Leah medicine that they didn't want to give her. Now they were being told not to give her medicine that they did want to give her.
I want to tell them the story of my grandfather, continued Martin. For the last 20 years of his life, he had to eat Epsom salts because he started using those laxatives and he couldn't stop.
Do they know what Epsom salts are?
Terrible looking stuff. Magnesium sulfate.
Kuo looked baffled. I'm not sure how he translated magnesium sulfate.
So if I could send my spirit back in time to talk to my grandfather, I would say, Grandfather, don't start down that road. Take Metamucil.
But don't put it in her formula, okay? Formula is milk, and milk constipates people. You might as well feed her glue. They could try putting the Metamucil in a bottle of prune juice, okay? Prune juice would unplug anything. That would be a real death bomb. Do they know what prune juice is? They obviously didn't, and neither did Kuo. When he reached that point in his translation, he simply inserted the English words prune juice into the middle of a long Hmong sentence. I preferred not even to imagine how he translated death bomb.
It is made out of plums, explained Martin. You take a plum and you dry it. Then you make juice out of it. I am going to write it down for them so they can look for it in the store.
And on a piece of yellow paper, in a huge capital letters, he wrote, prune juice. Nakao took the piece of paper and looked at it blankly. Even if he had been able to read the words, he had no idea what a prune was.
Now, Kuo, said Martin, Before we leave, I was just curious. I was noticing Leah has some bands on her wrists, and I was recently reading in a book about Hmong people and the Hmong religion, and I wondered, how did they explain what happened to Leah in terms of their religion? The Lisa's face closed as abruptly as a slammed door. He said they don't know anything about that, said Kuo. I thought, but they just spent an hour the other night talking about how Da steals souls. They would have gone on for another hour if Mei Ying hadn't had to get home. What had come over them today? It seemed as if my open, animated, garrulous friends, faced with someone they viewed as an authority figure, even though he would probably have quit his job before he ever treated them coercively, had entered a vegetative state themselves. They hadn't said 20 words since Martin arrived. They hadn't laughed, smiled, or looked at him in the eye. And then I thought, these must be the people Neil and Peggy have been dealing with all these years. No wonder everyone but Janine thinks they are impenetrable and stupid. Of course, Martin had undergone an equally unseemly metamorphosis himself from savant to bumbler. It was as if by a process of reverse alchemy, each party in his doomed relationship had managed to convert the others' gold into dross. Well, said Martin, rising with difficulty from the floor, it looks as if that is the best we can do today. They have my card, which, of course, might as well have been written in cuneiform. And they should remember I am here to help them. If you folks can get the prune juice, I would advise it. Goodbye, Mr. Lee. Goodbye, Mrs. Lee. As we walked to Martin's car with Kuo trailing silently 10 paces behind, Martin frowned. He knew that the visit had gone badly, but he couldn't put his finger on why. Had he not been courteous? Had he not shown respect for the Hmong culture by expressing an interest in the Lisa's spiritual beliefs? Had he not refrained from criticizing them, even when he felt they were wrong? I gave them my full shot, he said. You saw how patiently I explained things to them. He sighed, long and slow. I do the best I can. On some days, I think of Leah as a character in a Greek tragedy. By Euripides, perhaps. On other days, well, I just think about Metamucil. Chapter 16. Why did they pick Merced? My first day in Merced, several months before I met the Lees, I drove around and around in my rented car looking for Hmong and didn't see a single one. My friend Bill Selvage had told me one out of every 6 Merced residents was Hmong, and it was on the strength of that prodigious statistic that I had come. I thought he must have made a mistake. The people who strolled their babies along the sycamore-lined avenues north of Bear Creek and gunned their pickups up and down quaintly superannuated Main Street. I didn't know yet that most of the fancy business had shifted to the Merced Mall uptown. All looked as homegrown as characters from American Graffiti, which was set in Modesto, the next big town up Highway 99. When I stopped in the R Street Exxon for gas, I asked Frank, the man who Windexed my windshield, whether he knew where the Hmong lived. That part of town across the tracks is just crawling with them, Frank said. It's so crowded with Hmongs you can't hardly move. I sure know we got a lot of them. What I don't know is why they're here. I mean, why do they pick Merced? He then volunteered an anecdote about some Hmong who had been caught fishing in a county lake without licenses. When the police came, they got down on their knees. They thought they were going to be executed. He threw back his head and laughed. Martin Kilgore told me later that dumb Hmong stories were a lamentable staple of Merced's agricultural community, some of whose members had 100-year-old roots in the Central Valley. In Fresno, the Aggies make ethnic jokes about the Armenians, he said. In Stanislaus, it's the Portuguese. Here, it's the Hmong. There was the Hmong mother who heard a policeman say, "If your child misbehaves, you can always chain him to the TV," and took it literally. There were the Hmong farmers who fertilized their crops with human excrement. There were the Hmong tenants who punched holes in their walls to communicate.